Kia ora, Aotearoa, and welcome to Generally Famous. I'm Simon Bridges, and every week I talk to generally famous but always interesting guests about life, love, and what makes them tick. Distinguished journalist, now author, and hailing from Northern Ireland, Andrea Vance, welcome to Generally Famous.
Thank you. I thought you said you had four nice words about me. I only counted two.
Whoa. Distinguished journalist counts as two. What did I say? Now author. I was going to say renowned, but we don't know that yet, do we? Let's be honest. Northern Ireland is neutral, but I think that's nice. That was about seven.
Okay, actually, all right. Well, if you're counting not adjectives, it's yes, fine. Well, I won't quibble.
The school I went to, we didn't learn adjectives. I'm helping my children with these things right now. Actually, it's quite difficult when you don't know them yourself, but. As I have in my career, I fake it till I make it. Anyway, I feel like I know you very well, but actually I don't know that I do in a sense. I mean, we've never been out on a boozy night or at a long dinner or anything. I don't know how I first met you, but what I do remember, I think John Key warning us that you were very smart, pretty wily, and possibly scary. And then I think as a young cabinet minister, I did an interview with you, and I think those things were probably somewhat true, but it was enjoyable. I like you. And then over the years we did more of that, and I think I would stick with that. You're smart, you're savvy, I think a little bit wily. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think wily's probably quite correct. I think those are probably more accurate adjectives than the first ones.
and I suppose what I'd like to know from you is, what is the single favourite thing you remember about first meeting me?
Oh, well, probably not the first time I met you, because it would have been in sort of stand-ups or press conferences or... Mm. But I have a very clear memory of my first, significant impression of you. And you probably won't remember this, but it was at a National Party conference. I think it was in Wigram at the flight museum down there, and it had been a long day or a couple of days, and you of course were one of the young guns. You and Nikki Kay were the up and comers, the ones to watch. And I remember you and Nikki came down to the press room, and we were all filing madly about the day's speech, which I can't even remember what it was, and you brought us a whole lot of, like, a platter of cheese and a couple of bottles of wine. And yeah, it was awesome. I was like, oh, I quite like these guys.
I mean, you know, we didn't pay for it, right?
Well,
it was probably Wayne Eagleson or someone, the chief of staff, who said, Nikki, Simon.
Well, it did feel very natural, and you kind of sat around and had a bit of a yarn with us. And it was a really nice gesture, because often those things can be a bit tense and confrontational, and no one really, really wants us there. The yes. delegates certainly hate having us around. So it was a really nice thing to do. So that always stood out in my mind as not the first time I met you, but...
I mean, you don't sort of do that so much anymore, do you? You're not there at those. I mean, did you enjoy that part of the... gig?
I did about 10 years in the gallery, and I, of course, I loved it. It's the most exciting place to work, I think, in New Zealand journalism, because if the big stories don't start there, they certainly often end there. So, and it's so fast paced, and the adrenaline, and you get to interview and talk to some very smart people all day, every day, and I weirdly love select committees. I don't know why, but I just love attending select committees. Sometimes I just tune in. I love them, because it's a really great way to see who was good, you know, like which MPs were really making their mark by the questions they asked and their performance. So I love that. The party conferences I did not love so much, because, of course, you had to do them on the weekend, but also... And I don't want to offend anyone, but people that go to party conferences on a weekend for fun and are not being paid for are just a bit weird.
I didn't say that. I don't believe that, by the way, to all my former friends and supporters.
It's very important.
Yeah.
It's very important work, but still, it wouldn't be how I chose.
And it is a minority sport these days. It's not as if, I recently attended, not a political one, but an AGM on a Friday night, and I just thought, this is not what normal people do. I think you're right. You grew up in Northern Ireland. Where were you?
I grew up just outside Belfast. And it was, I grew up in that time during the Troubles, so that you will have, it's probably your only exposure to Northern Ireland in the media up until Dairy Girls first aired a couple of years ago.
We're coming to that.
Oh, we are coming to that.
You put me onto that, and I loved it.
Oh, did you watch it?
Oh, yes, but look, don't spoil that. Let's build the suspense of Dairy Girls. I don't know why I passed over it sort of 18 times on Netflix. The short didn't do anything for me. But anyway, let's come to that.
So, it's very good. I remember as a teenager sitting up and watching when the Belfast Agreement was signed at Stormont, and it was very tense, and we'd all voted on it, and I had this tiny little portable, you know, those huge TVs with the big backs,
yes.
And it was perched on my bedside table and just sitting up watching it late into the night, and it just was such a feeling of excitement, because it was like, oh, we might get normal. This might be normal life after this. And it just felt like a time of great optimism and hope, because I was trying to explain this to my husband. It's such the weirdest thing. We had these ads that would run, TV ads would run before streaming, of course, you know, in between Coronation Street or the news or whatever.
You're in the media. You need to watch the ads. Someone has to.
I know. No, the ads. Well, these ads were
they
remarkable.
They pay for it.
But these ads were advertising peace. So they're basically like, don't beat the shit out of each other. It could be good. And and set to the music of Van Morrison. So they were really, when I was a teenager, it was kind of that grunge era, and these catchy little rock tunes, and they were like, don't kill each other. It's going to be awesome. So it was a very weird thing to advertise peace on television. But that was the strange place I grew up in.
And but do you feel like you were... I mean, was it scary growing up? Because I suppose, you know, my sense would be people don't actually, growing up, feel scared, even if objectively they should, because it's what you grow up with, right? And it's the normal, you know, whether it's a household with problems or whether it's in Northern Ireland amongst the troubles.
It was normal for there to be soldiers and cops on street corners with guns, and it was normal to have your handbag or your school bag searched as you went into a shopping centre. And it was normal to, you know, for places to be evacuated. Bomb scares were normal. We joked about them. It was normal to have, you know, politicians on TV where their voices were dubbed because they were...
Yeah, what was that about? I saw this on Dairy Girls and I couldn't understand it.
It was so strange. So the very idea that Gerry Adams would be allowed to talk on the BBC was an outrage. And, you know, for obvious reasons, people were very offended by him. So you saw his face, but then it was the voice of an actor's face.
This somehow neutralised him somehow.
I don't know why anyone thought this was a good idea. But Northern Ireland is full of funny little quirks and symbolisms. And to the outside world, it makes total sense to most of us. But to the outside world, it's mad. Like our obsession with, as we call them, flags. Obsessed with flags. Flying any kind of flag will get you into a world of trouble at home.
Yeah. Because I think I'm right to say your father was a journalist, may still be a journalist. But, I mean, and so, you know, at that level, maybe you had some professional objectivity about what he did about these things. But were you, even if it was secretly, were you on a side growing up?
So my mum's family was one side and my dad was totally neutral, and so we were brought up totally neutral, so I never had a side. I
suppose, in a way, does that make it more perplexing, though?
Well, no, because it's just normal, and I understand all the arguments. Like, I understand why the IRA were fighting for what they were fighting for, and I understand why unionists were opposed to that, because they, you know, they're sort of fighting for their very identity, I guess. For Republicans or Catholics, I guess maybe the fight was so much more pronounced. It was much more vital, because it was things about employment and where you could go to school and jobs and your very survival. So so maybe in one sense it did seem more one-sided, but yeah, it's just normal. It just didn't, until you move away, I guess.
Abnormal,
I mean, it's awful.
I suppose, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's horrendous. Absolutely, don't get me wrong. It's terrible, terrible time. But when you're in the middle of it, I didn't know anything else, really.
And you've just been recently back there. And when were you there last?
The last I went back at Christmas, New Year 1920. So just before COVID turned our lives upside down. So it was nearly 2.5 years before I'd see my family. So.
And you've been living in New Zealand, what am I right, about 15 years?
Not quite. I think it's 11 or 12. I think it might be 12 at the end of the year. Right. So it was only meant to
be two.
You're
almost a teenager.
Oh, yeah. I really was only meant to be two, but it's not worked out that way.
I know that feeling. That was like Tauranga for me. And then somehow I became the Member of Parliament and, you know, I was strolling along the beach. It was wonderful. And I enjoyed that, by the way. But what was it like going back, you know, recently post-COVID?
Really, really, really good. Really good. Yeah. I'm sure lots of people are feeling like that. And you're about to...
Yes.
You and your wife's family are about to head back and do all that. The relief was enormous because I'd been clinging on to this. I tried not to think about it in the 2.5 years, but I would often wake up in the night and just be just terrified that something was going to happen and I couldn't get back. The thought of that was just unbearable to me. Mm. So I'd try not to think about it. And I just kept, you know, every time there was an announcement that the border would remain closed, I'd be sort of, but just move on to the next thing and I'll get there eventually. And just kind of praying nothing would happen. And I was really lucky. No one got sick. Nothing happened.
Because you've got what, mum, dad, siblings?
Yeah, mum, dad, sister, and then extended family, cousins, aunts, uncles.
And are you close to them?
Well, as close as you can be living on the other side of the world.
Well, are you like my wife, Natalie, who has like 19 WhatsApp sort of yeah. messages going between the hours of, I don't know, 6 a.m. and 9 a.m. and then sort of, I don't know what it is, but, you know, 5:30 p.m. and 10 p.m. And it's annoying when I watch anything on Netflix or something. She's always distracted by these ridiculous sort of issues and debates she's having with her sister and her mother and even her sister's husband's mother's on there now. I mean, it's like I just can't understand it. But I mean,
it's pretty, I do have ridiculous, probably with my mum and my sister. My dad doesn't have a phone. He refuses to engage in the modern world.
I like your father.
Yeah, I think you probably would, although he dislikes politicians. But you're a former politician, so you're reformed.
That's right. I'm a broadcaster these days, Andrea.
This is true. And actually, I think I was just thinking about this the other day. My dad once, the piece of advice he gave to me was, as this is a very typical Irishman, he said, never trust a teetotaler. So I was just reading Christopher Luxon's comments the other day about how he doesn't drink, he's never drunk, and I was thinking, oh, that would not go down well with my dad.
I have nothing to say about that. It's too soon, but it's an interesting comment you make there. Now, how did you... I suppose I'm trying to ask you, how did you find Northern Ireland this time? I mean, you're obviously being back, but I mean, is it a different country or a different place than you grew up in?
Yeah, definitely. So I've been away like maybe 20, I'm showing my age now, but roughly 20 years, roughly. I've lived in different places.
She came here when she was 7.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's changed every time I go back, even when I was going back really regularly, sort of every few months. But the pace has sort of accelerated. So we just celebrated like a quarter of a century since the Belfast Agreement. And when I was home, they had quite a significant election where Sinn Féin became the first minister, the largest number in Stormont. So quite a significant election, although I'm not going to go into details, but not quite as significant as was painted because nothing's really changed. Mm. But
I feel like we could have an election like that sometime in the next couple of years.
But I wish.
This is not a podcast about politics, I just want to say, but yeah.
Oh no, I was geeking. I loved it. It was great. It was really interesting. I loved being there for the election. And did the thing that journalists do the world over, like go to the pub and sit in the corner with the other journalists.
Yes.
But anyway, so it has...
Because you know Juno's over there.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, some really interesting journalists. So
I mean, being somewhere else changes your perception of the place. Being here and then going over there, how does that make you think about it all?
It's interesting that you asked me that because I have actually been thinking about that a lot because of the enforced separation in the distance. Although I chose to move away, when I was reading your book, I actually thought about this a lot. It kind of crystallised some of the things I was thinking, your book National Identity, obviously, that kind
Thank
of went.
You. I didn't ask her to do that, by the way, for those listening.
I feel
it was
like
not
should...
National Identity, Simon Bridges in all good bookstores. It's still there, by the way. Yeah. You know, some considerable. It had a lot of bad luck because it hit during lockdown, Auckland lockdown. I'm sure there were thousands more copies to be sold, but it is still a good book.
You went to number one, though. If I sell that many copies, I'll be delighted.
I think you will.
We'll see, we'll see. But so you were sort of examining yourself and who you are and where you stood in the world. And I was thinking about this, not just because of your book, but because I was being made to be away. And I guess the thing I was thinking is I don't have a New Zealand passport. I'm entitled to one now, but I've never applied for one because I just don't feel like a New Zealander. I'm not a Kiwi. And even though I immerse myself in it every day and I write about it for a living, and I guess COVID really, really hardened that in me. I felt, and I think a lot of other people who weren't born here and are expats who've moved here, immigrants, if you like, felt very alienated and isolated. Well, not everyone. Obviously, some people, you know, didn't feel that. But there was a sense that, you know, with the people who were stranded abroad, the anger that was directed at them and the feeling that, well, they should have come home, or, you know, the idea that they, how dare they live overseas in this great country.
It was strange, wasn't it?
It was very, I just felt, like I have never felt as less part of a community, I think, as I've ever felt in my entire life. I really didn't like it. This is not a criticism, it's just an observation, but I felt like, I obviously consume a lot of, content, a lot of podcasts, a lot of news, a lot of culture from home, and so I was absorbing the way that Irish and British people responded to it with that typical gallows, this is a very Irish thing, but that gallows humour, that sort of making light of everything, and whereas in New Zealand, everyone felt like everyone was taking everything so seriously.
We can be a bit earnest.
Yeah, earnest is the perfect word.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Oh, you're crossing into journalism there with your good words.
Earnest. How do I even spell that? My sons could, though. Yeah.
Yeah, and so I felt like I think I would have not coped better, but I would have had a better reaction if I had have been at home and kind of we're all in this together and the way that Ireland always deals with things. And
because
the British,
I presume,
too.
Now in Northern Ireland, when you're over there, COVID isn't even a thing. They're just getting on.
You meet the odd person who, you know, that 6 degrees of separation, someone who has COVID. Mm. No one's wearing masks and everyone's traveling and the airports are in chaos and whatnot. We've moved on to the next crisis, which is cost of living. So everyone's moaning about the cost of tea bags or whatever. I was thinking about this constantly, like who, as you were, I guess, when you were writing, like who am I and where do I fit in the world and what am I? Because I always had this intellectual view, I guess, you know, I'm very pro-immigration and I get very annoyed with anti-immigration arguments because I think that we're very, very lucky in where we're born. You and I were lucky because we were born in you know, comfortable, wealthy countries and it was just by chance, those circumstances. Mm. We weren't born in Syria or Ukraine or, you know, somewhere like that. And so I sort of feel like, why shouldn't people have a chance to move countries and
so would you say, you know, I mean, you'll be familiar with the, you know, it's, what is it, anywheres or somewheres. You're a sort of an anywhere.
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying?
Everyone should have a chance.
And in a way, I suppose, it's me talking, you know, you're not a nationalist. I mean, I on a bad day or a good day, I probably can be quite nationalistic.
No, definitely not.
Where would be your happy places? You know, I suppose Māori have a tūranga waiwai, you know. Where would you sort of say you...
I was in my rambling way, I was kind of getting to that. So I was intellectually, that was what I was thinking. That's what I thought. I always believed that borders don't matter. If you have a chance for a better life, you should take it and no one should stand in your way. Practicalities notwithstanding, and services and infrastructure and all those arguments that go along with the immigration debate. And I thought, you know, I can live out of a suitcase, I can be happy anywhere. Although I did miss home. But with the enforced separation, and then when I went home, I just was... And I felt comfortable, and all these things were familiar, and it was, and then I started to understand that concept that you were just talking about, to Rongawawai, and this is my place, and this is where I'm settled. And it was silly little things like, of course, it's the taste of the food, and our
which is like
habits.
What did you miss? What would you like if you were in Northern Ireland right now and you were
my absolute thing is soda bread. It's my absolute comfort food, and I do make it here, but it's not the same because we don't have the same kind of flour.
Yes.
And so the seafood. You guys have lovely seafood, but it's
but
not.
But it is different.
It's
in
not.
The,
yeah,
up there. Yeah.
It's not our frozen to death Atlantic sea.
Yeah, I don't like British / European fish and so on. They just,
oh,
I don't know.
Get out of Blech. Here. No. Blech. I am not having that at all. No, absolutely. But
it's tasteless and...
No, oh, come on. Well, you clearly...
No, actually, I you're completely right. No, it's not tasteless. It tastes too much. You're actually right. Yeah, I don't like the cods and the... You know, give me a snapper or a kahawai any day of the...
Right, I'm going to have to give you a list of restaurants to visit before you go, before you leave.
Well, one day I am going to go to, not that he's probably has anything to do with it, but I am going to go to Rick Stein's Padstow, whatever it is, and probably pay like 70 quid or something for a small piece of fish. And we should keep moving because there's so much to talk to you about, but I did want to say... Dairy Girls, I loved it. So Andrea put me onto that. I don't know whether it's appropriate or not, but my 10, 8-year-old and 4-year-old have also been loving it. Fortunately, to the extent that there's adult themes, they've been going over their head. It's amazing. And Natalie actually as well, she, like you, I mean, she obviously is not Northern Irish. But she grew up in Coventry and went to a Catholic school. And there are a lot of Irish Catholics at that school. So she found it very familiar as well, actually. So recommendation, Dairy Girls. I thought it would be, but it's funny.
It's very funny. And the thing that is a kind of a mystery to all of us in Northern Ireland, because we obviously love it, it's cherished now, but we can't understand where the rest of the world gets it. Like, there's very specific humor. So I think that it operates on two levels, because there's a very funny... episode, they're writing divisions on a whiteboard. You know, the priest's like, you know, what's different between Protestant Catholics and what's similar? And,
it's all differences.
And it's all different. And one of the things is Protestants keep their toasters in a cupboard, which to everyone in Northern Ireland is hilarious. It's very funny because it's true.
What is that?
But also, well, it just is. It's just a thing. It's just a difference. I don't know why it is But it was like
it
no one had ever...
speaks of deep repression or something.
Probably, yeah. But no one had like articulated, but everyone was like, oh, shit, yeah, absolutely. And so, but little things like that are hilarious to us. And also the Christmas cupboard, genius. Because we all have a Christmas cupboard. You keep your stuff for Christmas, like your nice chalky biscuits. And,
yes.
And your mum.
Oh, yes.
Your mum's
and they ate
the,
all of that.
Your mum's at the crazy price. Because during the Troubles, we didn't have Tesco or... I didn't eat a McDonald's until I was 18 because we just didn't have them. But... So our supermarket was called Crazy Prices, and so your mum would go to the Crazy Prices and buy the nice biscuits, but that's for the Christmas cupboard, so things like that. But anyway, so Dairy Girls, the reason it's awesome and the reason I recommended it is because it's very funny, but also Northern Ireland is having a cultural zeitgeist at the moment. Like, it's like 25 years on from the Belfast Agreement, suddenly... it's coming alive, and people are recognizing that we are our own little special place, and we are flipping awesome. And we have all these mad little sayings and little ways that are being celebrated in this TV show. And we have these very Northern Irish phrases, and now you can buy mugs and T-shirts with these phrases on
Brilliant.
It. How I would greet people in the street. I'd be like, oh, hiya, oh, hiya. And it's such a Belfast thing that no one else says that. But you can get a mug now. I actually did. It's tragic, but I bought a mug with, oh, hiya.
I went to Northern Ireland and all I got was this mug. You're sounding just an incy wincy but nationalistic,
No. But, well, because we're not, I mean, that would, oh, my God. Then
there's nothing wrong with that.
No. What I'm saying is we're our own little special place. We are forged because we are not Irish and we're not British, like, and people fight over these things, but we've sort of shaped our own little cool identity. And you can, I mean, are we a country? Are we not a country? Are we a province? Are we Irish? Are we British? You know, all those, and that's a debate that will rage on for years.
I have to ask you that. We've got to move on, but this is too much. This is too good. But yeah, would you growing up have said you're British?
I'm Northern Irish.
Mm.
I love going to England, but I'm not English. I lived in Scotland for a long time. I'd probably identify more as Scottish than anything.
Today on Newsable, why more Kiwis are worrying about money as unemployment rises. Plus, how Samoa is cracking down on its dengue fever outbreak and the little peanut butter that could. We have all the details about the Kiwi food brand teaming up with NASA and heading to space. For everything that's worth talking about, find and follow Newsable wherever you get your podcasts.
You are a journalist, and we do know, of course, that journalists are held in even lower regard than politicians.
And news car salesman.
Down there with some other professions, we won't get into that. But you are, I'm not a journalist, but I hung around with a lot of journalists over the years, and I actually like journalists. You're a senior, deeply experienced and distinguished one. Why'd you do it? I mean, obviously, I now know, I'm not trying to psychoanalyze you here, really, but I know your dad was one. You could have been an astronaut. Mm. I know you love your dog. You could have been a vet.
Mm. I wasn't very good at science, and there was no space program in Belfast, so neither of those things were available.
You needed a Stephen Joyce to get you one.
Yeah, that's true, actually. Yeah, that is true. Probably because my dad was one, and I grew up around it, and I remember being in his office with a typewriter. That's how old I am, and bashing away. Brilliant. My feet didn't hit the ground. And then my poor dad is a very wise man and recognised that journalism is not a profession that's going to get you into a lot of trouble. It's not going to make you any money. So he tried really, really hard to talk me out of it. And so he's like, right, well, if you're going to, you need to get some experience if you're serious about this. So he was the editor of three papers. And so he put me to work in one of the offices where he did not go very often. And so he put me to work in there, and he thought I would spend the summer. So I was doing my part-time job and I was studying. And then in my free time, I had to go and work in this office. So he thought I'd be doing like press releases about fates and garden shows and what day the rubbish was collected. But unfortunately, it was the year that the Drumcree riots kicked off. And so the town where I was working was one of the towns where that was, it was a flashpoint. So there I was attending the scene of pipe bombs and bonfires and very exciting. And so then from then I was like hooked. So it had the absolute opposite effect of what he intended.
And I don't know if I should, I don't know how you feel about this, but I love it. And I have to mention, you were, of course, News of the World.
I know.
Then through to The Scotsman and now obviously Stuff. And so that's a heck of a ride from a sort of naughty tabloid to, I'm sorry, Sinead Boucher, love Stuff, amazing, but, you know, slightly more on the earnest side of the, to use that word again because you liked it so much, spectrum. I mean, what a heck of a ride. How do you reflect on that?
Oh, I think people think that I should, you know, I often get abused on Twitter, like that News of the World hack. And I'm like, yeah, well, I was proud of it. I was 7 years. I did really good work there. Yeah. And I think people obviously have the impression because of the bad behavior of some,
yes,
some reporters that subsequently were prosecuted for their bad behavior. But in my time there, you know, the thing I liked most about it was that you gave, and this is true, I think, of all journalism, maybe not political journalism, it's kind of the opposite of that, but you give a voice to people who do not have a voice. These people would ring up and they'd be at the absolute end of their tether with whether it was the local council or, you know, like there was one series of investigation we did on these people who were getting these cars from these, you know, basically corporate loan sharks and just, you know, they couldn't afford to make their payments, and then they'd take the car away, and then they had to still pay for the car, but also the penalties on top of that. And so these people were at their, you know, they'd be crying and they'd be at their wits' end, and you go and you'd get the photo with the angry face and the arms folded, and then you would ring up and you'd be like, oh, hey, it's Andrew Vance here from the News of the World, and there'd be just like a intake of breath, and almost every time you could make these people's problems go away because they'd be like, oh no, we're going to be in the News of the World on Sunday. And
yes.
So that's the other side of working for. But I had.
I mean, I don't mean to.
Times.
I mean, I don't mean to take it down a notch here. I mean, my wife accuses me of always bringing things down to the lowest common denominator. But it is a thing. I understand this could be complete nonsense, but I understand one of your first stories was of a woman who said that she saw the baby Jesus in her baby scan. I hope she didn't call it Mary. At her?
Do you know
this true?
I never knew what happened to that baby. But yeah, it was my first day on the job. They were
it's
like
a very special child.
Yeah, they were. I can't remember the name of the. I can't remember the name of the suburb, but it was somewhere in West Glasgow, and I got sent out on my first day on the job to see this baby.
Oh, so you were doing News of the World from Scotland?
Yep, I was in, well, basically, I was in Scotland, and my patch was, I worked in Glasgow, Edinburgh, and then Glasgow, and then back to Edinburgh, and my patch was basically from the east coast, from the border, right the way up to Aberdeen and Peterhead, and all the way up there. So I used to drive like 500 miles a week all over Scotland. I used to love it. But yeah, no, Jesus in my baby scan. But also,
do you think she was for real?
Well, it did look like Jesus. Like, you know, there was no denying it.
Oh, so you saw the scan, and and there he was, the Christ.
Of course. I mean, you know, we do have to demand proof on some occasions, even at the News of the World.
It wasn't just a lame attempt by a pregnant woman to get herself famous.
I think she got 400 quid for it. I think that was the going rate for a page lead at the time.
Brilliant.
But, or maybe it was 250. Anyway, so yeah, no, I had some classics of the genre. Ned's blew up my hamster, so that was Ned is.
This is like Ricky Gervais in that Life or whatever it is on Netflix. God. You know where he goes in and sees the kind of two. I'll probably get cancelled for this, but whatever it is, you know, morbidly obese people talking about their burger eating competition or something. This was you.
Is it true?
Ricky Gervais modelled himself on you at News of the World.
I do recognise a lot of journalism in that show. It's the local newspaper journalism, certainly. But yeah, no, Ned's Flip, my hamster was a classic. But I did other stuff. Like, I remember spending quite a long period of time in a bush trying to get a photo of Elle Macpherson, the Australian model, because the story was she was at this health retreat. And so away, me and the photographer went, and we spent all day in this bush in a damp Scottish forest in the north of Scotland. And I remember getting home really late that night. It was a Saturday. And I remember getting home really late that night and thinking, this is my Saturday night. And getting ready for bed and having to pull a tick out of my leg from crouching in this bush all the day. And we never even got the bloody photo. Good, it was a waste of time.
I once met Elle Macpherson.
Did you? Well, I didn't get to meet her.
No, I didn't. But I was at St. Luke's Mall as a pimply teenager, and she was there doing the catwalk with some other models, selling her... I think it was the tartan sort of range of lingerie, and she threw some out in the audience, and I got some of her underwear.
Did you?
I mean, not her underwear, but her Rangers underwear, shall we say. So there you go.
You got better than me.
I can do highbrow, right? I don't want you to think that. And you recently, certainly this year, won a global award with Ian McGregor, who's a good guy, for outstanding biodiversity work. Congratulations on that. Tell us about that.
Thank you. Yeah, I've gone from kiss and tells at the News of the World, which I was really good at, actually. That's like writing softball.
I'm salvaging your reputation at this point, right?
It's beyond salvaging. It's definitely beyond salvaging. Ian and I spent a year last year working on the biodiversity crisis. So this, everyone talks about the climate crisis, but the biodiversity crisis is equally as troubling. And New Zealand happens to be, because it is a biodiversity hotspot, and we've got all these amazing creatures, and we're such a new country, the impact that we're having on these native species is much more pronounced. So it was a good place to do it, but heartbreaking. So we spent a year in these wild and wonderful places, places that no one else gets to set foot in, really.
We're Subantarctica, of these islands I don't even know the names
yeah,
of.
Yeah, we went to all of the Subantarctic groups, and then another place. Oh, it's incredible. It was my third trip down there, and I just love it. It's a place that's in my soul. It's a wonderful place. And then Rangitira, which is a pest-free island off the Chatham Islands, which most people have never even heard of. And it was, it's literally alive with birds. Like at nighttime, you look up and the sky is swirling with these incredible seabirds. So it was amazing experiences. And then we put it together for stuff for a 7-part series that seems to have been really well received. So we're just, we're trying to work on a second series of it, but we're looking for sponsorship at the moment. So if anyone wants to pony up.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, it's important. And I mean, my sense is you are an environmentalist. You feel strongly about this. Is that sort of fear? I mean, I'm not, you don't now want to say, no, I don't.
No. I have always been interested in it because, well, not to take it back to Northern Ireland, but when I was growing up, there was this local fight. We had this quarry, the cement quarry near where I grew up, and it's you know, very coastal area, and they wanted to put a landfill there. They wanted to fill the quarry with rubbish, and so the local community fought for years and years and years, and it just was like quite a big part of my childhood growing up, because my dad would be writing about it, his paper would write about it, and my mum was on the beach cleaning up and all that kind of stuff, and so I've always been interested in it. And what happened was, I promise there is a point to the story, but what happened was eventually the community won, which rarely happens. Mm. And the quarry is now a major set for Game of Thrones.
Wow.
Yeah. So actually some good did come of it. It turned out that we didn't have to destroy the environment to make money.
Because Game of Thrones, it was quite a bit of that.
All of it was filmed in Northern Ireland. Oh, so amazing. It's been a bit.
Well, that would have been
it.
Good for the old economy.
Yeah, well, it was like Lord of the Rings for New Zealand. It was just a huge money.
Yeah, people do, don't they? Actually, Natalie's sister's busy friend, because she did acting for a while, was the stunt horse rider, one of the, probably had 50. And that's right, it's Northern Ireland, isn't it? Yeah, amazing.
But weren't you an extra? Weren't you an extra in Xena?
Hey, who's interviewing who here?
What is just it?
I've been an Asian warrior in Xena, and some sort of other variation of warrior back in the days when I could possibly remotely take my shirt off in Young Hercules. And we were doing star fighting with our shirts off behind the main characters, which was, it wasn't Kevin Stobo or whatever his name was, it was someone else. But look, enough of that. I feel like we've done this topic to death.
A great career.
I couldn't stop without asking you a little about your new book. You are now an author, and this is your first book.
Mm, yeah.
Do you pinch yourself?
I am, yeah. It's slightly terrifying. Like, I was so naive when I was coming off making the documentary series for Stuff, and I am like a magpie. I'm always grasping for the big next new shiny thing. I'm always like, right, what's next?
So you're like, I'll do that.
Yeah, and so the HarperCollins rang me up and asked me would I be interested, and of course I've always wanted to write a book, and I was like, yeah, I'll do it. And I thought to myself, oh, it's probably like writing maybe 10 features. It's no problem. Like, I'll rattle that out and, oh my God, it's the hardest thing I've ever done.
What sort of word count is this?
75,000.
Yeah.
It is a lot.
I did 50 proudly and 50,000 and sent it to them and thought that would be a wonderful thing. And they said, yeah, that's good. Another 25, thanks.
Really?
I won't tell you which chapters were the last 25,000. Actually, they are my favourites, but it is. And are you... Is it scary?
It's terrifying. It really is, because, like, obviously I write every day of the week and send stuff through and it gets published. And yes, it gets published in a newspaper, but there's a... the worst thing for a journalist is getting something wrong. It's just hot. It's the thing that keeps you awake at night. And we talk about having the dawn fear. You know, and you've got a big story that's coming out at 5 a.m.
Believe you me, I know the feeling from a politician's perspective.
Oh, shit,
what did I say? No. Oh, no.
So you're like,
John
you're
Key
awake.
Will not be happy.
No, I'm like, exactly. Well, I had the dawn fear for exactly the same reason. John Key's not going to be happy.
Yeah.
But you do... you do have that thing where you wake up sort of 4 in the morning and the thing goes live at 5, or it's in the, you know, the paper that people are about to start buying. But at the same time, you have that, but you also know that, you know, like, it can be corrected online, or and it's yesterday's fish and chip paper or that kind of thing. Mm. You know, it's not as, but when it's a book, it feels much more permanent. So, and also, I guess it's secondary. It's not as important to me, but it's like, what if everyone hates it? What if it's rubbish? So,
how do I come out of it?
Very well. I would say
yes.
I would say there's two villains and many heroes in this book.
Oh, wonderful. And my former colleagues are worried, should they be?
Yes.
moving right along. Now, I want to say dub, but do is your pride, your joy, your
like
love.
Scooby-Doo, yeah.
What is do in Gaelic, is it?
It means black.
And it's a she?
She, yeah.
And breed?
She's a Shar Pei. Like a rolly dog, like the toilet roll ads.
Yeah, beautiful. And I can look, I can understand your love, but I don't have to ask. I see her on Twitter like every other day. You're clearly obsessed with her. What is so special about Do?
Oh, she is. I feel like I want to jump in and say not every day. Occasionally I'll post on Twitter. I've got nothing else to say on Twitter because it's a hell site, but photos of Do tend to go quite well. So I am the worst dog owner because you're supposed to keep them in a cage when in their first few days. She was on the bed immediately. I was like, there's no way she's going in doggy jail. And we didn't take her to puppy training. And
so she doesn't believe she's a dog fundamentally.
She is the queen of the household.
She is a human.
And she's very independent. They can be quite aloof anyway. They're a bit like cats, Sharpeys. They don't really do pats. And she goes her own way. So we go for walks. We go up the hill in Wellington. And she'll be having a run around with the other dogs. She loves other dogs. And she'll be running around. And I'll call her name. And I'll call her name 10 times and 10 other dogs will come to me and like heal. And Do will just be like, when I'm ready, human, this is my walk. But I love that about her. She's fiercely independent and she's a little diva. So that's
wonderful.
Good.
I love dogs. I'm a dog person.
Yeah, but you give yours away.
So. Yes. No, well, ours. Well, I now I need to tell the story because I don't want people to think that we are awful, horrible people. We are that, but not in relation to the dogs. No, our latest Jasper, or as my wife calls him, Jasper's. Unfortunately, our body corporate wouldn't allow dogs, and some nasty person was rather nasty. So that's very sad.
I think it's true, though. I do stand by that kind of strongly, that people who don't like, I don't really like people who don't like dogs. It says a lot about a person.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's right. So you don't like my mother.
Your mother's delightful, I'm sure.
Yeah, she just doesn't want to. Something speaks to her childhood. But anyway, you can read that chapter in the book. Now, to wrap up, I ask every guest three questions until I'm bored of them. Not the guests, the questions. It's the general knowledge section. Firstly, what single object, if you could take only one thing, would you save from your home?
I really struggled with this question because
you can't say Do.
No, well, I
needs to be,
I know,
inanimate.
I did pick that. so I did. I think probably I did. I was thinking about this quite. This question really baffled me because everything I was thinking of, I was like, well, I could replace that or I can get that back. So it's probably, I have a box of mementos, things that people have given to me, and the first postcard that my husband ever wrote to me, and all that kind of stuff. So I probably grab that. But then as I was leaving the house this morning, I was thinking, and I just spotted it out at the corner of my eye, I have, for the entire time I've been in New Zealand, I've searched for a griddle, which is a flat pan, and it's you put it on stove, and it's how you make soda bread. And I have not.
But does the griddle has that? That's got the sort of the
a flat pan.
Right.
And I have searched all the secondhand shops I could have ever went in, and I've never Briscoe's, I've never been able to find a griddle. And eventually, my mum took pity on me, and one came back with me. She gave me her griddle.
That's
and
love.
It came back. Yeah, it came back to me. So it would probably survive a fire, to be fair, but I'd probably grab that on the way out.
Yes. What is the best night you've ever had out? And as someone who's Irish, this better be good.
I think I'm going to disappoint you with this because I know you do know about some of my more scandalous nights out, but I actually, one of the most memorable nights I've ever had in my life, there was alcohol involved, but I was on my honeymoon.
How crass that you assumed I was talking about a boozy alcoholic sort of bender.
Well, I do conform to the stereotype of an Irish woman, but so I was on my honeymoon in Africa, Botswana, I think, and
amazing.
We did this nice night safari trip thing where we weren't staying in a fancy hotel because we were poor then, still poor but not as poor, and we they drive you to a watering hole, and it's a fancy hotel, and you sit and you can have drinks and watch.
And acts like you'd stayed at that fancy hotel.
Well, yeah.
I know that feeling.
Yeah, I know. So the actual guests were in the better... Anyway, never mind. And there was a storm, and all these creatures were, you know, hippos and elephants were drinking at the watering hole, and it was just spectacular. And we were sipping brandy, and it was warm, and it was lovely. So you do that for a little while, and it was really nice. We were with some other people on the tour, and then... We got back in the truck, and, you know, it was one of those trucks with the sides are open, you know, there's no doors. And as we were driving, all of a sudden the driver, the guy sort of not screeched a hole, but stopped quite suddenly and turned out the lights. And we were like, oh, what's going on? And suddenly we were in the middle of this herd of elephants.
Amazing.
And the guy is like, please do not move. Do not use flash cameras. Just, you know, so we're all sitting there not breathing because we're surrounded by these. And so you couldn't, your eyes eventually adjusted a little bit, but it's the smell and the noises of the elephants, like, you know, their trunks were sort of sniffing the truck and so close that you could, you know, when you put your arm down, you could feel the hairs of them.
Wow.
And they were that close. And it was a big herd of about 30 elephants, and it took quite a long while for them to pass through and around the truck. And then at the end, the big mama elephant, because there was little calves as well, kind of, she stays to the end, and then she went across the road. And it was just the most, because it was dark as well, and your senses were heightened, it was the most magical, because I'm mad about animals, it was the most magical experience. So I'm sorry it wasn't...
That is uplifting. I was, you know, I was hoping for a story of you at the end in a gutter, you know, sort of with teeth missing and a tattoo on your face or something.
Yeah, but I don't remember those moments. So.
But that is very uplifting. What is the best advice you've ever been given, and who gave it? I hate these sort of questions, but I think they are revealing.
It wasn't advice, but when I was at the News of the World, which is it wasn't my first show, it was my second job, but I was really young when I started there. So I was like 20, I think, when I started. And so I was very green. And they would it's such a harsh newsroom, and such a competitive newsroom. You're in competition with each other and other papers, and high stakes and high money. And you would never be allowed to give up. You could not give up on a story until the absolute. You would be there. They keep you there till lights out. So we'd be doing stakeouts, and you're not allowed to leave until the lights went out in the house, and then you had to be back the next morning. But you'd have to call and call until you got a no. And so, I mean, it's in a very aggressive tabloid style of journalism, and that's not how I operate now. But it did teach me, and my boss, Douglas, did teach me just to never give up on a story. Mm. So sometimes when you think it's totally hopeless and you can't, you know the story's true, but you can't quite prove it, like, just come at it from different angles, talk to someone else, or, you know. So I just never, ever give up until I absolutely exhausted every line of inquiry. So that's probably not necessarily a piece of advice, but it was the way I was taught to work.
Fantastic. Well, you almost, I hope my children aren't listening to this and deciding that they want to be journalists after all of that. Well,
there's no money in it.
Exactly. But, you know, some other great rewards. Andrea, it's just been great to have you. Andrea Vance, very smart, not that scary. Say hi to Do, and thanks for coming on Generally Famous.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Generally Famous. There's a new episode every Wednesday. You can listen to them all at stuff.co.nz/generallyfamous or wherever you get your podcasts. In fact, if you follow us on Apple or Spotify, any of the podcast apps, in fact, you'll get the latest episode automatically. Sounds good, right? Thanks to my producer, Chris Reed. I'm Simon Bridges. I really appreciate you listening.
If you liked listening to this pod, help us make more like this. Visit stuff.co.nz/support.
If you don't have time to read the in-depth stories, or you just prefer to listen instead, the Long Read from Stuff is the podcast for you. Each week we showcase one of our excellent pieces of journalism, telling important or entertaining stories from the world of crime, sport, history, culture and more. You also get to hear from the journalists themselves about how they uncovered the story and how it came to life. So for your weekly dose of long-form journalism, beautifully read, subscribe to the Long Read from Stuff wherever you get your podcasts.